I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the American Museum of Natural History. I also owe the Simon Center for Computational Astrophysics and Stony Brook University for my funding. Today I'll be talking about chaos and what does it have to do with black hole binary mergers. So it's informal, please feel free to interrupt or ask questions as I go, happy to take them. So two bodies make a binary, thanks to pioneering efforts by Kepler and Newton. The idea is that if you know the positions and velocities of two gravitationally bound objects at some initial time, you can predict their positions and velocities at any future time. So the orbits are periodic, no chaos is present. You perturb one of these systems, you get back a steady state. So for example, if you perturb the system on the left, we'd get something out like the system on the right. If you introduce a third body, however, all hell breaks loose. So this is a numerical simulation of a scattering experiment between a single star and a binary star system. These occur commonly in dense star cluster environments, such as globular clusters. We think the centers of galaxies, nuclear star clusters. So this is courtesy of Aaron Geller, who's at Northwestern and the Adler Planetarium. And so the idea here is that the three-body problem is a well-known example of chaos in nature. So there is no analytic solution that predicts, given the positions and velocities of the bodies at some initial time, what their positions and velocities will be at any future time. The system tends to evolve if the total energy is less than zero in the form of a temporary binary with a temporary single star that tends to go on these prolonged excursions. And eventually the system will decay, leaving behind a stable binary system and an ejected single star. And so as I said, these interactions occur commonly in the cores of dense star clusters, and very frequently, one or more of the participants is actually a stellar mass black hole. All right, so what is chaos? So this is a plot showing as a function of time in units of the crossing time. An example, three-body problem. So all bodies are released from rest at t equals zero, and the only source of acceleration is gravity. The parameter shown on the y-axis you can regard as the distance from the origin. It's actually distance defined in terms of an initial homology map. But the basic point is what these authors do is they run a series of these three-body scattering simulations. And they start every interaction with roughly the same initial conditions, though they release all bodies from roughly the same positions, distances from the origin in position space. And they run a number of simulations, perturbing the initial state only slightly. And the basic phenomenology that you observe is for some initial time, the trajectories follow each other quite closely, but then over sufficiently long periods of time, they start to diverge. And so the takeaway message from this is that you start with one set of initial conditions and you end up with a distribution of outcomes. And so you might know this as the butterfly effect. And just another example. So over sufficiently long periods of time, trajectories diverge in space, and you can quantify this using a Lyapunov exponent. Here we have another example illustrating the concept of chaos. So this is courtesy of Johan Samsing and his collaborator. And what these authors do is, again, they're running a series of single binary scattering experiments, just like you saw in the simulation I showed previously. Each time they run a simulation, they vary very slightly the initial orientation of the binary and the initial impact parameter or separation of the single star. So they're launching the single star directly at the binary and perturbing where they launch the single star from initially, very slightly. And they run the simulations, and every time a simulation finishes, they record the outcome and they classify the outcomes into different categories, assigning each a color. So for example, the three at the bottom, these represent exchange interactions, where the single star that comes in ends up left in the binary, and it exchanges one of the other stars that gets kicked out. You can also have a direct collision. So in these simulations, the authors assume finite sizes for the particles, and they also include dissipative effects of general relativity. So collisions and mergers are certainly possible. So direct collisions shown by the black, gravitational wave-induced mergers shown by the red. And what we see in these diagrams of phase space is a combination of regular and chaotic behavior. So some more examples here. So Johan Samsing, who's a collaborator, he actually showed these in an art gallery at Princeton University, since they actually make for some very pretty illustrations. But they contain useful physical information about the evolution of single binary interactions. And so we see some regions of very regular behavior. So these are regions where you have a uniform color. And the idea here is that small perturbations to the initial state give out exactly the same outcome. Okay? But we also see regions of chaotic behavior. So these are regions like we see here, where there is no single dominant color. And so we can zoom in on these regions and look at them in a little more detail. So this is what Johan has done. So here we have a zoom in of these topological maps of the end states of single binary scattering. And we see that there's a combination of regular behavior that sort of decays into truly chaotic behavior. And so the idea is that very small perturbations to the initial state give a completely different outcome, okay? So one initial configuration or one scattering simulation for a given assumption about the particle masses, the energy of the interaction, and the angular momentum of the interaction, this gives out a distribution of outcomes for a truly chaotic system. Okay, so this is the takeaway message. For a given set of initial conditions, there is a distribution of outcomes. Okay, so we start with a well-defined set of initial conditions. We do not get back out a predictable answer for the initial state, chaotic.
Is that distribution converged in any real sense?
So in what do you mean by convert?
So you might imagine drawing a patch in your initial condition space and then just asking how many, you listed I think six or so outcomes. You know, how much of the time does it end up in outcome three?
Right.
Right, but as you shrink the size of that patch, I imagine that fraction will evolve.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question, I think. So you could ask, so for example, the authors, when they run these simulations, they obviously assume some step size when they kind of rotate the binary every time. So you could imagine that they assume rotating the binary initially by some angle theta, and you could ask them to then redo the simulations, but divide their binning size by a factor of 10 or a factor of 100, and then how would this behavior change? For example, would you see this regular behavior extend further out? And I don't think they've actually looked at this in a lot of detail. But what I'll actually be talking about is how to take these initial conditions and map them to distribution functions for your outcomes, so what you actually expect for the outcomes. So hopefully we'll address that question to some extent. All right, so just another example to help drive this point home. So this is showing the performance of an integrator created by Hannah Rain at the University of Toronto. His integrator is called Janus. And what these authors do is they start with this initial configuration. So they assume 1,000 particles. They put them into an initial configuration that spells out the name of the integrator. And at a time of zero, they release all particles from rest. And the only source of acceleration is gravity. They iterate forward for 500 time steps until they get what we see here. And then they flip the sign of the velocity and integrate again for another 500 time steps.
So what do they do here in collisions?
These are all point particles.
So when they are on top of each other, they just keep going until they don't finish?
Yeah, so I'm not actually sure. So usually you invoke something called regularization to deal with that problem. And integrators can handle it properly. This is actually a bitwise integrator. So what the authors kind of do is they take position space, you can imagine, and they sort of grid it up into discrete bins. And so you can imagine there's somewhere I can draw. So the point here is that they've created a fully time reversible integrator. And so the question is how to do that. And the way they've done this is they sort of bin things. And then if you are actually storing the positions that particles move forward through in phase space according to some well-defined discrete bin, then it's relatively straightforward to integrate backward in time and re-achieve the initial state that you started with.
Right, but you have to make a decision that you have two particles that go into the same plane. It's made out of, well, they destroy, they combine, and then we have zero velocity and twice the mass. Or it just went by it, etc. So if I do the former, I cannot reverse that process.
Sure. So yeah, I'm not actually sure how they handle this within Janus. But in general, integrators for star cluster simulations, they don't handle this problem in a self-consistent way that gives you a time. That the problem is not time reversible. So the equations of motion are time symmetric. So when you perform this operation, you would expect, using a leapfrog integrator, which is what is generally used for star cluster simulations, you would expect to recover the initial conditions that you started with. But due to computational error and the fact that the integrator is not symplectic, you do not recover the initial conditions that you started with. So effectively, computational error builds in this effect that is analogous to chaos. And so the takeaway message from this, so you might be asking, how can you then trust a single simulation for star cluster evolution? And the answer is you can't. What you really want is, for every set of initial conditions, you want to run lots of simulations to get a distribution of outcomes. And so this is not what's done in star cluster simulations, since the computational expense is too great. Generally, people choose a set of initial conditions for their n-body models, heavily limited in terms of the number of particles, since the integration time scale is n squared. They run their simulation for billions of years, and what they get out, they compare directly to observations of star clusters in the Milky Way, and they try to make comments about what this is telling them about the initial conditions. And so the point here is that this is a very dangerous thing to do if you can't beat down the statistics properly to account for these chaotic effects. Yeah?
What is the order of the symplectic integrator in the genus?
Sorry?
What's the order of the symplectic integrator in Janus?
I'm not actually sure. I haven't spent a lot of time looking at Janus, so it's a pretty recent paper, and I have not actually used the integrator yet myself. But
most star systems are binary, so has there ever been any detection of chaotic behavior
in a binary star system? I guess I would ask what you mean by that. My first thought, I showed a binary star system and sort of discussed perturbing it and getting back out a long-lived steady state. But real stars are not point particles. They evolve, they lose mass. There are tidal effects. So there are definitely some chaotic components to any realistic binary star system. I guess I'm not sure what exactly you're asking for.
Chaos.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah, so I would say yes. And so the reason for this is if you take an n-body simulation and you evolve it forward through time, you're assuming point particles, you're not actually realistically treating any of the realities of a star. So, for example, stars have convective envelopes in a lot of these star clusters that we're looking at. And you could imagine that they have sort of convective cells that are burping out fluid, and this imparts a very tiny momentum kick. And so these things are actually creating a truly chaotic system that is not being accounted for by your simulation. So even if you can time reverse and get right back out what you started with, I don't think that is representative of a real star cluster, what you'd expect, or even in a real binary star system. So for example, if you want to do binary evolution, that's a very hard problem that nobody's really been able to solve very well. All right, so what does this have to do with black holes and gravitational waves? Okay, so just a brief review. I'm guessing most people here are pretty familiar with what has been detected recently by a LIGO. So I'll just highlight the important features of this. So if you compare what a LIGO has been detecting in terms of the black hole mergers to what's previously been found using X-ray studies, the masses of these black holes are much higher than anything we've been able to observe before. Ignoring supermassive black holes in the center of our galaxy and Andromeda, for example. There could be several reasons for this, but this may be a strong indicator as to the astrophysical environments in which these types of mergers are occurring. So there are several biases if you want to actually be able to identify a black hole in a binary star system. For one, it has to have a luminous companion, and so that could be a reason why, in general, these black holes that we observe via X-rays tend to be of low mass, since they require another companion that is luminous, and so cannot be too much, so the black hole cannot be too much more massive than the luminous companion, whereas if you put one of these black holes in there, that would not be true. So these black holes represent much more massive objects than we had previously been able to observe directly. And so to just, I'm guessing everyone's seen this. The takeaway from this, for my purposes, is that in order to get two black holes to merge, you first have to put them into a binary star system. And so this is the question that I'm going to be addressing. How does this happen? How do we get two massive black holes together in a sufficiently compact binary star system that they can merge within a Hubble time? And the environments that I'll be focusing on are globular clusters in the Milky Way, mostly. Although globular clusters in other galaxies within the local group are very comparable in general to the globular clusters that we see in the Milky Way. Depending on the environment, so more massive galaxies tend to have slightly more compact clusters due to the stronger tidal field. But in general, we're talking about very massive star clusters with very high central densities that are ideal for swapping these types of black holes into pre-existing stellar binary systems. Okay, so all stars are born in star clusters, and by extension, all black holes must also originate in clusters. And so what kind of environments are we talking about when we're talking about these especially massive stellar mass black holes? So here's an example. This is the old globular cluster M80, which is found in the halo of the Milky Way. So these behemoths tend to weigh in at over a million solar masses, so they have total masses in excess of a million times the mass of the sun. Their central densities can get so high that they are in excess of a million solar masses per cubic parsec. So to put that into perspective, the distance between the sun and its next nearest neighbor, Proxima Centauri, is of order of parsec. So if you took that pair and you put it right in the middle or the core of a globular cluster, you would find that roughly 100 stars fall between them. So these are much higher stellar densities than we see in the local neighborhood. And the stellar densities are so high here that from based on a simple mean free path calculation, the collision rates can also be high. So rates of collisions between single stars and binaries or between pairs of binaries. And the rates can be of where you can have encounters happening on timescales less than a million years. And these things are thought when we age date them. So if all stars are in a cluster, that's actually a very convenient thing. You can get a pretty good handle on the age of the cluster. And all the globular clusters in the halo of our galaxy tend to have ages of order 10 to 12 billion years. So they're almost as old as the galaxy and the universe, in fact, itself. So there's been lots of time to, for internal dynamical evolution to have significantly affected the binary star populations in these clusters. And they tend to have binary fractions of order 10%. So what that means is that if you take the fraction of point, or if you take the number of point sources and you ask what fraction of those point sources are actually unresolved binary pairs, the answer is 10%, somewhere between 1 and 10%. The most massive globular clusters tend to have slightly lower binary fractions since they're dynamically hotter environments. So the velocity dispersions are higher, which means that the relative velocity at infinity for direct encounters involving binary stars is higher. And because of this, these things tend to be very efficient at dissociating binaries. In globular clusters, it's not so bad that you actually deplete all your binaries. You'll always have a binary fraction greater than 1%, so over 10,000 binaries or so. But in something like a nuclear star cluster, where the velocity dispersions are more than a factor of 10 higher than in globular clusters, really you don't expect any binaries. And I'll talk about that very briefly. Okay, so what do these look like as they evolve through time? So this is a fast-forwarded N-body simulation, courtesy of Anna Sipple and Jeremy Webb. The black points actually show black holes, or the red points actually show black holes forming in the cluster. 1 second in the simulation corresponds roughly to 1 million years in real time. And the way these things tend to orbit throughout the cluster is stars are on these rosette-shaped orbits. And this is the picture you should keep in mind when we talk about the internal dynamical evolution of star clusters. And since globular clusters are very massive and they have lots and lots of stars, it takes them a very long time to dissolve. And that's in general why we still see them in the halo of our galaxy today. Whereas a much lower mass cluster, an open cluster, like where we thought the sun was probably born, these things tend to disperse and dissolve within of order a few 10 million years. Sorry?
What do you mean by an open
cluster? So open clusters, they just tend to be the nomenclature. So if you look at the core of a globular cluster, it's not open, it's closed, basically. You can't see through it. In fact, you can't do radial velocity surveys of the center since the densities are so high, the region is very, very crowded. Open clusters, on the other hand, the densities are low, so you can see through them. They're open, and you can do radial velocity surveys. And this has actually been very valuable. People have been able to do very long-term radial velocity surveys of open clusters, so in excess of 30 years or something like this. So they've actually been able to find many, many binaries. And the binary fractions in open clusters are 50% or higher. All right, so let's zoom in on the core of a globular cluster, and we'll find a black hole, and we'll follow it as it moves throughout the cluster. And so the black hole will very likely find a stellar binary system on a relatively short time scale. It will form a temporarily bound, chaotic three-body system. It evolves as we've seen before, so you always have pretty much a temporary binary and a temporary ejected single star. And what we'll see in this simulation is that the black hole actually exchanges into the binary system. And so by having these single binary or binary-binary interactions, you can effectively swap stellar mass black holes that were single isolated objects into binary star systems.
But the opposite can also happen.
It's less likely. So in general, in these simulations, the less massive object is typically the one to be ejected. And black holes are almost always more massive than the stars in a globular cluster. So globular clusters are sufficiently old that all the stars have masses less than the mass of the sun. So all the stars have masses of 0.8 solar masses or less, give or take. And the black holes are obviously going to be more massive than this by at least a factor of 5. And so the probability that you'll eject a black hole in one of these interactions is low. I would say you'd have to run. Sorry? How would you test that?
Now, how would neutron stars? You were saying all this, the masses would be below 0.8.
Yeah, so neutron stars, you have the probability is higher that they can be ejected, but you're still likely to retain the neutron star in the binary. This will work just as well almost for neutron stars. And so in this simulation, what we saw was, so we saw a star get kicked out. It left the black hole behind in the binary, and then the simulation followed the star, which then encountered another binary star system. And a collision happened, leaving behind a collision product in a binary star system. So we could have just as easily followed the binary that the black hole was swapped into. It could have gone off and found another black hole. And then you could have another exchange interaction happen. And now you have two black holes in a binary star system in a dense environment. So that if subsequent interactions occur with single stars in the surrounding population, these should effectively harden the black hole binary further. So the net effect of these interactions, if you don't have an exchange, is to reduce the orbital separation of the black hole binary. So you send a single star in at some velocity, and you send it out at a higher velocity. So it leaves with more kinetic energy than it came in with, leaving the binary with more negative energy, and so its orbital separation shrinks. So these dynamical interactions should contribute to reducing the time scale for black hole binary mergers. Okay, so what does this tell us? What can we learn from these effects? So from the A-LIGO observations, learning about black hole masses directly, this actually tells us a lot on the astrophysical side about what these globular clusters looked like when they were first being formed, very early on when the galaxy was being formed. And so we have the potential here, if we can understand, take these observations of these black holes and somehow figure out a way to rewind back in time to what the progenitors of the black holes looked like in their progenitor star clusters.
What's a smoking gun to assigning into a globular star cluster origin as opposed to a, say, a common envelope or chemically homogeneous?
So I would say, well, low spin in the product would be one thing. So there's no reason why you'd expect the spins of the black holes to be aligned. The net effect will also be to create more massive black holes than you would expect to see in an isolated binary star system. So the fact that these black holes are more massive than what we've been seeing in X-ray binary systems that are isolated in the galactic field. So those are, I think, more what we would expect to evolve just from isolated binary star evolution. Whereas in a dense globular cluster environment, the assumption of isolated binary star evolution is a risky one. So a common envelope scenario can certainly happen. It's certainly something to worry about, definitely. Yeah.
Eventually, we'll have enough detectors that we can triangulate and determine the origin of emergence. So in that case, it's possible, likely, that we'll see mergers in galaxies and not in globular clusters.
Sure.
So what would you say about that?
I would say, I would say just because they don't happen in a globular cluster doesn't mean that you didn't form a compact black hole binary in the globular cluster in the first place, because they can be kicked out pretty effectively. So if you have, I'll go over this more as we go on, but the basic way that black hole populations evolve in clusters, because they're more massive than the other stars in the cluster, there's an energy equipartition effect where the black holes tend to slow down. And because of this, they sink deeper in the cluster potential. And so if the conditions are right, the black hole subpopulation, let's say you have of order 1,000 black holes, they all sink to the center of the globular cluster. And if this effect is strong enough, the density of this black hole subcluster becomes very high, and all the black holes start undergoing very strong interactions with each other. And they can kick each other out of the cluster very effectively. So for quite a long time, actually, people really didn't expect to see any stellar mass black holes in globular clusters. They thought that they had all been dynamically ejected relatively early on in the lifetime of the globular cluster. More recently, some people have been challenging this claim, especially since in 2012, we actually started observing, or we think we've been observing stellar mass black holes in globular clusters. The way we basically do this, or try to distinguish them from neutron star binaries, is by comparing the luminosity in the radio to the luminosity in the X-ray, arguing that because the black hole should have jets and the neutron star shouldn't, then the ratio of radio to X-ray luminosity should be higher than the black holes. But I know Josh Brindley he's found at least one binary star system that is actually very luminous in the radio as well. So it's not one-to-one that if you see a high ratio of the radio luminosity to the X-ray luminosity that you're for sure looking at a black hole with a jet, but it's compelling evidence in favor of black holes and globular clusters.
The templates which determine the masses and spins in LIGO analysis based on GR. If you modify GR slightly, you would get different templates with lower masses.
Okay. So would you? I guess I have not a great sense of how much freedom there is in that. So you don't believe the masses?
Not much, but enough.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, that would actually be really interesting. So from my perspective, I don't care so much what the masses are. I just want the masses in order to be able to learn something about the astrophysics early on in the formation of these clusters. But it's obviously very useful to know not to necessarily trust absolutely the results. All right, so we want to do this, basically. We want to figure out a way to take what we're seeing now, 12 billion years after these things were formed, and say something about what they were like early on. So why don't we just run a whole bunch of simulations? So we pick a set of initial conditions, we run the simulations, we see what we get out, we compare it to what A-LIGO's observing, and we find the set of initial conditions that best matches up with the observations, and then we feel we've learned something about the initial conditions. To do this properly, because of the effects of chaos, this would take thousands, millions, perhaps even billions of simulations. So the question is, how can we move forward? How can we address this problem? So let's consider an example. So let's assume that we know how globular clusters form. Okay, let's say we know how the initial protostellar gas cloud collapsed to form stars. We know the properties of those stars after they form, so the distribution of stellar masses. We know how many of those stars are actually in binary systems to begin with. We know the properties of those binary star systems. Let's assume that we then know how all those stars are going to evolve and die to form black holes. We really, really don't, but let's assume that we do. Let's also assume that anything that's in a binary, we know how to evolve internally that binary star system. If we know all of this information to start with, this still only brings us to of order a few hundred million years after the cluster was born. So this still leaves us with over 10 billion years of internal dynamical evolution that we have to account for. So what I'll talk about is how we can actually address the cluster dynamics over this long period of time in order to try to get back an initial state and say something about these things. So the idea is to take what we see now and account for the internal dynamics. And so that's what we're going to talk about. And so there are two problems here. As I mentioned, there's the chaos and then there's an initial conditions problem. So using computers to solve both of these problems simultaneously is currently not feasible. So for example, to run one n-body simulation with about 100,000 particles, this can take, to do it realistically, of order a few months. If you put about 10% of those objects, of the objects in the cluster into binaries, it takes even longer. This significantly slows down your computer runtimes. So what we can try to do, or what we're going to try to do, is we're going to come up with a method to effectively handle the chaos and reduce the problem to just an initial conditions problem. So as I mentioned, chaos takes some initial state, and it gives you a distribution of outcomes. So we're going to try to figure out how to do this mapping for the problem at hand. So we start with some population of stellar mass black holes in the cluster. So if we can rewind back to this point where we know what the masses of the original black holes we started with were, and if they were in binary star, how many of them were in binary star systems, we want to figure out how globular clusters take this, evolve them dynamically, and generate compact black hole binaries that then merge and to be detected by A-LIGO. And the way we can do this, so together with working with Nick Stone at Columbia University, we've been adapting an approach originally pioneered by J.J. Monahan in 1976. So Monahan came up with the smooth particle hydrodynamics formulation that you might be familiar with, but he also spent some time dabbling with the chaotic three-body problem. And so what we've been doing is we've been adapting the work for the chaotic three-body problem to the chaotic four-body problem. And so to do this, we use an ansatz, and we assume that every final state of a chaotic four-body interaction is achieved via some variation of strong three-body scattering. And so what we do is we're considering encounters between two binary star systems. Okay, so we start with two binary star systems. We choose the masses of the particles, the properties of the binaries, and then we throw them at each other with some relative velocity at infinity. We're going to fix our initial conditions. So we fix the particle masses, the total encounter energy, and angular momentum. And this fully specifies the initial state. And then we're going to map that to a distribution of outcomes. And so for the chaotic four-body problem, there are three possible outcomes. So in the three-body problem, there's one if there's only point particles, right? You always end with the ejection of a single star, leaving behind a binary. So with the chaotic three-body problem, if you start with a hyperbolic single star, then you'll actually always end with a hyperbolic single star, so you can't actually form a stable triple system in the Newtonian limit with all point particles. So the four-body problem has these three outcomes. We can either get back what we started with, so we put in two binaries initially, we get back out two binaries, we start with two binaries, we get back out a stable triple system and an ejected single star. So when we form a stable triple system, these tend to be hierarchical. So what this means is that you have a compact inner binary with a triple or a tertiary on a very wide orbit. So the outer companion, the third companion, is on a sufficiently wide orbit that it effectively sees the inner binary as an isolated single star. And so the triple is stable indefinitely in the point particle limit. And the last possibility is that we eject two single stars sequentially and leave behind a stable binary star system. So what we want to do is for each of these different outcomes, we want to figure out how to take the statistical mechanics approach, take a set of initial conditions, and map them to distributions of outcomes. So we want the distributions of binary orbital parameters for any leftover binaries, so orbital separations, eccentricities, and we want the velocities of the ejected stars. So singles in these two cases, or the ejected binaries in this case. And so we use the statistical mechanics approach, so it's a density of states per unit energy that we take. We basically write down the density, an expression for the density of states, and we rework it such that we are able to calculate the functional forms of all the distribution functions for our final leftover binaries and single stars. And so this is what I'm showing here. I'm showing a comparison between our analytic formulation and the results of numerical scattering simulations. So in these scattering simulations, we're assuming two identical binaries. We throw them at each other with a fixed relative velocity at infinity. So the energy and angular momentum are fully specified initially. And the only thing that we vary are the relative inclinations between the orbital planes. And we run millions of simulations, all with one solar mass particle, so they're all identical stars. And we get out for each of our different encounter outcomes. So the blue is the 2+1+1, the black is the 3+1, and the red is the 2+2. The solid lines show the results of the numerical scattering experiments, and the dashed lines show the results of our analytic formalism. And so on the left plot, we're showing the distribution of binary orbital energies. And on the y-axis, we have the normalized fraction of our outcome. So we effectively normalize such that when we integrate over these curves, the area under the curve is unity. And we find for the binary orbital energies that our function or our analytic form is actually able to reproduce the power law dependence of the orbital energy distributions quite well. So we're able to reproduce the general shape of the distributions for all three outcomes. If we look at the distribution of ejection velocities for single stars, both single stars formed in the 2+1+1 outcome, as well as the single star left over from the 3+1 outcome, again, The agreement between our analytic formalism and the results of the numerical scattering experiments are quite good. So with this formalism, we're able to take an initial state and map it to a distribution of properties for the outcomes of these interactions. And we're able to do this for all three outcomes of the chaotic four-body problem. And so what you can do with this effectively is there's the potential to revolutionize simulations of star clusters. So for example, I've been talking mostly about n-body simulations of star clusters. So these operate by making every particle in the cluster a point particle, calculating an acceleration on every particle induced by every other particle in the system, and then iterating forward through time to figure out the time evolution of the system. But there are other approaches, more statistical-based approaches for modeling the time evolution of globular clusters. So for example, one popular approach now, which is very useful because it's much less computationally expensive than the n-body approach, is a Monte Carlo-based approach, where you're using statistical approximations or a field-based approximation to model the global properties of the globular cluster through time. And then you use a few-body integrator to calculate the outcomes of direct single binary and binary-binary interactions in the core of the cluster. And so these model, they use the field-based approach to model the host cluster properties through time, and then a few-body integrator, they calculate for whatever initial conditions they start with and chaotic effects that the computation outputs, they get out their final distributions. But what this will allow you to do is take that same approach, so a field-based approach for the global cluster evolution, take some initial conditions or initial properties for your binary star systems and evolve the distribution functions through time. So you take the initial distribution functions and you use our approach to propagate them forward. And so this is taking effectively accounting for the chaotic effects and turning it into just an initial conditions problem. So for every set of initial conditions, when you fully specify your binary orbital properties, the properties of the host cluster, you don't need to run thousands of simulations to get statistically significant results. For example, for how many compact black hole binaries you would expect. And so this is a work in progress, something that we're currently trying to implement. Yeah?
So do you have some intuition why the agreement between the dotted and the solid lines are much better at higher ejection velocities and not that good at lower ejection velocities?
Lower ejection velocities. So you're over here, or?
Yeah.
Do you mean around here?
Yeah, why is the agreement that higher ejection velocities looks better?
I think most of this is just noise in the simulations, to be perfectly honest. It's a valid point. We should certainly, ideally you want to run more simulations so that you're able to get good convergence. The problem with a 3 plus 1 outcome, which is probably why you're seeing, so for example, the noise in the 2 plus 1 curves is a lot less severe than in the 3 plus 1, is because in the 3 plus 1 case, the fraction of simulations that will actually produce this outcome is relatively low. It's of order a few percent. So your statistics, so if you run a million simulations, your statistics for this outcome are much poorer than for this outcome by a factor of about 5. So I expect most of this to be noise related.
And the same question for the other plot, these shoulders, do you have a sense of what's going on?
Yeah, so this is where I think the most work needs to be done. It's what's happening beyond E0 over EB equals 1. So where exactly this peak is occurring, we're able to account for this to some degree with our formalism right now. But yeah, this needs more work, definitely.
Do you think it's a defect in your theoretical model, or do you?
Well, there's something in our theoretical model that is not accurately predicting. Something's happening to the power law at very low energies. And so oftentimes, when you look at the assumptions that you input into the analytic formalism, they're breaking down in certain regimes. So for example, There are causality issues which come into play that are not accounted for in our analytic formalism. So if you're producing very wide binaries, for example, it becomes actually kind of tricky to come up with causal ways to eject a single star at sufficiently high velocities. And so your assumption of ergodicity breaks down pretty badly. And so that's one assumption that we make. We assume that the parameter space is populated uniformly. So we assume an ergodic system. And that does definitely break down in a few cases. So for example, at very, very high particle mass ratios, we start to see that break down a little bit. At very high relative, so energies close to zero, we start to see the assumption of ergodicity break down. Anytime something is being launched at it at, and you get a direct outcome without any long-lived resonant behavior. So it turns out though that for the black holes in globular clusters, because they're more massive and they have lower velocities, you could actually calculate the distribution of relative velocities at infinity. And where our formalism actually starts to break down tends to be at a virial ratio, so the ratio between the total kinetic energy to potential energy of about 0.4, 0.5, and about 98% of black hole interactions involving black holes in clusters should have virial ratios less than this. So for the black hole case, our formalism is generally pretty robust. The other point I'd like to make, so just for anybody who's interested in triples, Lidov-Kozai effects, is we have a prediction actually for the properties of these stable hierarchical triples that you form during binary-binary interactions. So we know the distributions of binary orbital energies for the inner and outer orbits, distributions of eccentricities, as well as the distributions for the relative inclination angle between the inner and outer orbital planes. And so this is some work that we're now testing with further numerical scattering experiments. Okay, so just to give an example of what you can do with this. So this is taking single binary scattering and using the exact same approach I just discussed for the four-body problem and looking at the evolution of black hole binaries in galactic nuclei due to dynamical hardening. So we consider 10 to the 4 black hole binaries that we put in the center, or in the galactic center, so the nucleus in the center of the Milky Way. We put it at the influence radius. We calculate rates of encounters, and we set up a Monte Carlo simulation to start with 10 to the 4 black hole binaries. And for each one, evolve it through time due to a combination of single binary scattering and inter-encounter gravitational wave emission. And we consider two different cases. We consider isotropic scattering, and we consider planar scattering, and as well as several cases between these two limits. And so we're trying to quantify the effects of having an isotropic nuclear cluster versus an anisotropic or rotating nuclear cluster. And so the blue points are showing the results for the planar case, or so applicable to like a rotating nuclear star cluster, and the red points are for a spherical isotropic star cluster. On the x-axis, we have the logarithm of the initial separation of each of our black hole binaries. And on the y-axis, we have the logarithm of the number of single binary encounters that are required to wind the black hole binary down to an orbital separation that is small enough that the binary will merge due to gravitational wave emission before a subsequent interaction occurs. And so the takeaway message from this, so that the solid lines are actually showing analytic calculations for how many interactions it will take ignoring gravitational wave emission. So this should be more or less our upper limit. And what we find is that planar scattering is actually much more efficient at hardening black hole binaries than is isotropic scattering. And this is pointing to possibly an expectation that it's easier to merge black hole binaries in rotating nuclear clusters than it is in spherical nuclear clusters. However, the reason for this basically has to do with the distribution of ejection velocities. So you have a broader distribution for the planar case. And so what tends to happen is that you have an initial single binary interaction that very effectively hardens the black hole binary. such that it is not disrupted during the second encounter. Whereas in the isotropic case, you have a very high probability that it's disrupted during the second encounter. And so the planar case winds these things down due to dynamical hardening more effectively. And in the isotropic case, we have a larger fraction of disrupted black hole binaries due to single binary scattering. But even still, overall, because the velocity of dispersions tend to be very, very high in nuclear clusters, most single binary interactions actually disrupt our black hole binaries before they get a chance to merge. One of the ways around it is to look at heavily rotating nuclear clusters. There are some reasons to expect that this might be able to avoid this problem to some extent by reducing the relative velocities at infinity. So for example, if you're in an AGN disk, this might be a good place to effectively harden a black hole binary. But I think a lot more work needs to be done on nuclear star clusters and what to expect.
So what happens if you do the same exercise but with higher masses?
For the black hole binary? It will take more encounters to harden it.
And how the disruption? Would it be easier or more difficult to disrupt?
More difficult. It'll be more difficult for the same assumption about our initial binary orbital separation.
Well, what I'm shooting for is that would this, can you see a path to explain why is it like what's seen preferentially like?
You've disrupted the lower mass ones, basically. Yeah.
So it's also true that the higher masses allow you to see them further, so they are statistically biased to see those.
Right.
That could be more standard explanation.
So if we can get a handle on where they're happening, and if it's looking like it's the center of a galaxy, for example, then yeah, I think that's a scenario where you can all of a sudden potentially make a claim like that and start to say something, which would be really exciting.
When you say that 90% of the binaries are disrupted before merging, are all of those 90% though? Is the gravitational wave merger time much longer than novel time?
I think for our initial setup, I can't remember off the top. I can check. I think so for the initial configuration. Yeah. So disrupted. I mean, we could ignore gravitational wave radiation, and it'd still be 90% are disrupted, basically. So I'm running out of time, so I'll just try to make these last points quickly. So this is an n-body simulation of a star cluster. On the x-axis, we have time. On the y-axis, we have mass. And what we do, so we have a somewhat massive black hole sitting at the center of this cluster. It has a mass of a few hundred solar masses, whereas the second most massive black hole has a mass of a factor of a few smaller than that, a factor of a few smaller. And we put a point on this plot every time there's a strong interaction between the object of the indicated mass and the central most massive black hole. And so as I described earlier, we find that the black holes, which are indicated in maroon here, they all sink to the cluster center and interact with the most massive black hole on the shortest time scales, and they tend to be ejected in an order going from most massive black hole down to lowest mass black hole. Actually, we find that the second most massive black hole pretty quickly forms a binary with the central massive black hole, and it's this pair that are effectively ejecting the other black holes as the star cluster evolves through time. And so with our analytic approach, we can actually calculate what we expect for the distribution of ejection velocities, as well as the evolution of the orbital properties of the central binary due solely to direct dynamical hardening. There are other formulations that have been developed to deal with perturbations and everything from the background population. But our approach will handle the direct integrations. And so this is one problem that's the time scale problem that's not really accounted for by our formalism. But there are actually, so with our formalism, we can calculate what I call branching ratios, or the fraction of each of our three possible outcomes that we would expect. But for a very complicated system like this, a subcluster of black holes sitting in the very center of your cluster, you want something to try to come up with probabilistic decay chains for the order of ejection events as the cluster evolves. And so with a student, I've been doing some work looking at trying to develop a half-life formalism for taking gravitationally bound systems that decay. So for example, I show here the results for our familiar four-body problem, where we have our three individual outcomes. On the x-axis, so this is log of the time that the interaction lasts for. So these are just distributions of lifetimes for binary-binary scattering experiments. And on the y-axis, again, we have a normalized fraction such that the integrated area under the curve is unity. And we try to describe the lifetime distributions with an exponential fit in order to calculate a half-life for each of our three outcome scenarios. And the idea is that if you can fit a half-life formalism to this, then you can calculate directly the probability of obtaining a given decay chain for these types of decaying systems. And so with the four-body problem here, we've actually been able to get this half-life formalism to work relatively well. So this is a comparison between what we get from calculating half-life. So for each of our three outcomes, we get an expected half-life. And then the basic prediction here is that the ratio of these half-lives should be equivalent to the outcome fractions for each of our three different outcomes that we get directly from the simulations. And so we compare the solid point, show what we get from the half-life formalism, and the open symbol show what we get directly from the simulations. And so this is the case that I was showing on the previous slide. So these are all equal mass particles, since on the x-axis, we've just varied the number of heavy particles involved in the interaction. And so these are with one solar mass particles and 10 solar mass particles. So four ones, three ones, 1 10, two ones, 2 tens, and so on. Again, normalized fraction on the y-axis. This is just showing that for the four-body problem, at least, our half-life formalism actually works pretty well. And so the basic idea is that the 2 plus 1 plus 1 scenario is by far the most common, so it has an outcome fraction of order 85%. And so that means that the lifetime distribution should have the shortest half-life, and this is exactly what we find. And so we're working to develop this further to try to figure out probabilistic decay chains for the sequential ejection of black holes in globular clusters. And that's it, I think I'll leave it there and take questions. Thanks very much.
Questions?
So can you go back to the slide where you fit the exponentials?
Sure.
Because there seem to be two curves for each.
Yeah, I buried something. So, so actually, yeah, if you actually, the blue here, so what we realized when we did this, the code outputs the final lifetime of the entire interaction. And so we realized what we actually want, though, is the time scale corresponding to the first ejection event, which is much shorter than the time scale for two ejections to happen. So that's actually not shown on the plot. So if you compare these directly, it doesn't agree with what I show on the next plot. But I think you were asking about these secondary Gaussians. And so ideally for this problem, you want to look at cumulative lifetime distributions and fit for a half-life directly. But when you try to do that with this problem, the 3 plus 1 outcome causes you major headaches because it doesn't work well with a cumulative distribution. It's just a long power law, whereas the other ones are nice exponential curves. So we had to find some other way to fit the lifetime distributions. And the reason why we have two fits here is since the primary fit, which covers about 80% of the simulations, this is what we were using to get our half-life estimate. And then the secondary Gaussian you can use to get an uncertainty on that fit, since it basically you can quantify directly by taking a ratio of the areas of these two, the primary and secondary Gaussian, how much of your primary Gaussian is actually describing the data, and how much the secondary Gaussian is needed to correct for what you're missing.
Can we go back to your point about the integrators?
Sure.
So you were emphasizing the fact that Janus was time reversal invariant.
Right.
But did you use that somehow? I missed your point there.
Yeah, so the point basically was You cannot trust a single n-body simulation of star cluster evolution.
Okay.
If you were trying to use something like Janus, there's the potential to move towards a fully time-reversible integrator. I don't think you want to do that in the long run. So this was just showing that. So, to be perfectly honest, I really like that plot from Hannah Rain, and because it really nicely shows. So this is the LeapFrog integrator is what's actually being used in most n-body simulations of star cluster evolution, and it's a nice comparison showing that these simulators are not time reversible.
Yeah.
And so there's a computational error effect that's compounded over your integration runtime. And you can come up with integration techniques that avoid this and save you from this problem, but you have to think carefully about whether it's the integration technique you want for the problem at hand. And so for star clusters, you do want to be using the LeapFrog integrator over the Janus, but it has problems. Sorry?
Why?
Because Janus removes the chaos, which should be there. So you could ask, so this is effectively what it's doing. You could ask again if I were to.
Why would it remove it? It only changed, can allow you to have time reversal. You have to chaos. Chaos, you also have time reversal.
So, I guess I would go back to my point that stars are not point particles. In a realistic star cluster simulation, you have continual perturbations.
But the LeapFrog could be severely overestimated the amount of dissipation in the system or something. So, I mean, it doesn't mean that Janus would get bad and LeapFrog would get it better.
Right. I agree with that. Yeah.
Just to go back to somebody else's question, too, it is formally symplectic, Janus is. And they can do second through 12th order or something like that.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But it's only a formal, it's a more subtle question with Janus than you would expect.
So how do you have binary collision and you still recover time as well?
I can't.
How is that possible?
Well, I guess that's the other reason.
Do they remove the collision by hand in there?
In Janus?
Yeah.
Do you actually know how they?
I don't know how they deal with collision.
Yeah.
Because if you have perfect time reversibility, you have to
There's something I thought has been done.
No, they're very good questions, and exactly, these are the things you want to worry about if you want to use Janus for like a star cluster simulation or something like that. Absolutely.
But why would you need to remove collisions by hand? I mean, they're quite particles.
You got dressed in by hand. Either you're not capturing the true physics, or you're ignoring something to allow for reversibility, because a collision would just break it down.
Right.
So something is, some magic is being done there.
When we have collision, the
magic just
increases. You don't have time reversibility. You can't have time reversibility.
This is classical. It's not quantum. There's no quantum. We've done this.
Yeah. Maybe classical, yeah.
It's probably even softened. When you say LeapFrog, do you mean Wisdom Holman? Do you mean LeapFrog?
I can't remember if they use Wisdom. I don't remember. I think LeapFrog. I'd have to check.
Because it's Hofstede.
Well, but I thought that was a symplectic integrator.
It is. LeapFrog is. I was surprised when you said it wasn't symplectic.
No. This symplectic doesn't preserve the volume of phase space.
Yeah.
Which these two things are not equivalent.
Well, let me suggest we thank Nathan for things you've got in the too technical, and then those who want to keep asking questions. But for that, so let's thank Nathan.